Well, Aidan, great to talk to you here on Premier League Live and Talk Sport. Before we start talking about your book, The Nearly Men, you might just give us a bit of background on yourself. I know that you come from a real football stronghold in Newcastle.
I sure do, yes. Grown up in Newcastle, lived a few other places in between, but I'm back there again now and quite enjoying the ride at the minute. Reminds me of the heady days of the 90s under Keegan, which is when I loved it the most. But yes, I'm a football writer, not a full-time occupation, sadly. We would love it if it was, but I'm part of these Football Times, where I do writing online in their glossy magazines, and I do podcasts with them as well.
Yeah, funny you said I that's when I loved it, because it brings back that memories of that famous Keegan quote. I would love it, yeah. I would love it. Anyway, we're here to talk about, your book, The Nearly Men, and the World Cup Finals is obviously the biggest sporting event on the planet, and it's upon us. So if you're a certain, I suppose, age, certain vintage, you would remember so many great tournaments with so many nations who thrilled us with their flamboyant football. And, I just want to ask you, first of all, I suppose, Aidan, why write this particular book on the World Cup, The Nearly Men?
I think it's because it's a theme that just kind of grabs you, or it certainly grabs me. It's the whole what-if scenario. I think that's endlessly fascinating. I'm thinking how things might have gone a little bit differently with the odd little twist of fate here and there that might have gone differently, whether it's the bounce of a ball or one incident that might have gone one way or another. Or just imagining what we think was the correct result in some cases. We've all felt injustice on the football field, whether it's with our team or a team that we happen to have enjoyed watching. You feel the pain. You kind of share that pain in some respect. So I think, and as you rightly said, the World Cup being the biggest sporting event, which undoubtedly is, it just heightens that same feeling when you see an injustice or a perceived injustice in your mind of, it's not the right result, it's not the way it should have gone, or it's not the way I would have liked it to have gone. Sometimes it's fabulous teams play such wonderful football or leave such a great legacy. Look at the Dutch of the 70s and Hungary missing out in the 50s, things like that. It just doesn't seem right. So it's lovely to sort of speculate and celebrate those teams. So I guess that was the main reason, is partly to celebrate them and to look at what made them great despite not winning. Because the World Cup's a short tournament, isn't it? It's only it's a small sample size, really. It only takes one game going wrong and all those years of work are gone. And if that happened to be the peak of that team, the chance is gone and may never come back. So it's kind of a celebration of to tell their stories, like stories that you need to learn about and know about, because it isn't all about the winners. There's so much more to it, and sometimes the best team in a cup isn't the one that wins.
And I was interested when you said the Dutch there, because I read through your book, Aidan, and it's just one of the quotes that stuck out was from Johan Cruyff, and he said, "Maybe we were the real winners in the end. I think the world remembers our team more."
Exactly. That is the perfect summation of the whole book, I think. I guess that's probably the inspiration, is knowing Cruyff and his views. I guess he's the sort of embodiment of this idea when it comes to World Cup football. And in many ways, I think he's absolutely right. The world does remember his team more because of their flamboyance, their style, the just manner of it, and I guess the revolutionary aspect of it. They pushed the game in a new direction, and we're still seeing a lot of what was instigated by that team today in how Guardiola's teams play, for example, and things like that. So it's had a deep influence. And yes, we think of them far more than we do of the West Germany team that beat them. So yeah, that's the perfect quote to encapsulate the whole idea.
Yeah. Could I ask you, Aidan, who would your favourite nation be to watch in World Cup finals gone by, outside of England, obviously?
Oh, crikey. I think it varies over time because it depends on who's particularly good at the time. Yeah. Now, when I was growing up, when I was a young lad, my first World Cup was the 1982 World Cup. So I was blown away by Brazil, the bright yellow shirts and the incredible football they played. However, that's kind of ruined Brazil for me a little bit. I kind of expect them to live up to that, and they don't. They just never do. So in my mind, they should be like that all the time, all that swagger. and yet they're just dot. So I kind of get a bit disappointed by them. Denmark, I always love to look out for similar reasons from 1986, the similar style. Yeah. And equally the Dutch. I just love a bit of the Dutch arrogance about it all, the flamboyance. So they're another one that I love to look out for. They're so colourful. I think the colour actually helps. All three of those I've mentioned have got sort of fairly vivid colours. I think that helps a little bit if you combine that with flamboyant play. And, you know, in my mind, that's what they do. I think the Dutch are probably the ones who stay true to that over time. And they're always an entertaining watch. So, yeah, possibly they're the one to go for.
European nations have enjoyed great success, of course, in World Cup finals. When you look at Germany, won it four times, Italy four times, France twice, Spain more recently, and England going way back, as we know. is that a point of frustration that England, you know, have threatened so many times to win World Cups and haven't quite delivered?
If I got too frustrated by that, I'd be a bitter and angry man. I couldn't possibly cope with that. I think there's an inevitability to the defeat in many cases, and you just have to accept it. I guess it's a bit different in more recent times, having got very close, and the Euros last year was a bit painful, obviously. But in the normal course of things, no, it doesn't. I feel a day or two of disappointment, and then I'm back to just enjoying everybody else, because otherwise it would just spoil the whole thing for me.
Yeah, eight different winners since 1930. Obviously, it's not easy won, the World Cup finals, you know.
Exactly. Most teams are never going to come close. So to come close every now and then, that's a big achievement, really. You can't judge international teams purely on trophies.
Yeah, and I was interested to note your first World Cup finals, Siri, but younger than me, was 82. But I remember, me being a Man United fan, I remember Brian Robson against France scoring the quickest goal in the World Cup finals, and that bullet of a header as well. You know, I was always a big Brian Robson fan.
Yeah, I mean, what a start to a World Cup. But I guess Italy showed in that World Cup that starting slowly sometimes is the best way. But yeah, I remember seeing that around a friend's house as a young kid. And thinking, oh, this is great, because obviously I'd never seen an international tournament before at this point. England hadn't been in one for some time in terms of the World Cup, but I'd missed all that, really. And just seeing that 20-odd seconds from the start, it's like, oh, this is great. Is this how it's going to be, is it?
Yeah. And I read in your book as well, I mean, you reference Italy, for example, being the host nation in 1990.
Yeah.
And they lost out. They beat Ireland, of course, Republic of Ireland, on the way into quarterfinals of that tournament.
Yep. I mean, yeah, this was a time, I mean, obviously the Irish will know this well from how fabulous that tournament was for Irish football. But this was a time when Italy was the Super League of its day, wasn't it, really? Mm-hmm. You know, this was the centre of the footballing world. I guess the Premier League is getting close to that now in some aspects, but not on the level it was, because all of the best players were in Italy then. Absolutely all of them. The teams were magnificent. The stadiums looked like out of this world. We were starting to get the TV coverage of it as well on more obscure channels at that point. Channel 4 was to come a little bit after. But, you know, this was the centre of the footballing world, and Italians felt this themselves. They'd had a big lull, a big dip after winning in 1982. You know, they kept people on a bit too long, and so they had to go through that pain, I think, and then rebuild. Euro 88, another big one for Ireland, of course. But Italy did well again there, coming through the semi-finals. So by 1990, they just saw this has to be. It was their destiny. They knew it in their heart and soul that they would win. And yet, of course, it all went horribly, horribly wrong in that semi-final, having got past Ireland in a narrow quarter-final. Then the semi-final with Argentina, they still hadn't conceded the goal at this point, of course. Mm-hmm. They felt impenetrable. But as soon as they did, as soon as Caniggia flicked the ball in with his blonde locks, Zenger made a little mistake. That one incident, that one goal, and suddenly the whole thing began to crumble. And, the confidence just drained away, because the certainty they'd had throughout, even in close games, and they'd had several, even in those close games, they'd come through it. They'd found the formula. It was Scalacci, who come from seemingly nowhere, though he was a top scorer in the league.
Yeah.
And Baggio, of course, the young hero coming through and emerging. This it was so certain to them, and it all just fell away. And it had to be Maradona, and it had to be Naples, and that was just the biggest pain for them. But yeah, it was just the sheer certainty of it. It wasn't a hope. It wasn't oh, I really hope we make this. I hope we win. I hope we can do it at home. It was, no, we are going to win at home. And then when it didn't happen, it was just calamitous. And to Italians, that failure stung far more than the 1994 failure, which is bizarre if you think rationally in terms of a penalty shootout in the final in 1994 and Baggio's miss and all of that. But that team wasn't as celebrated because it had, you know, he dragged them through. They weren't that good. Whereas in 1990, they were fabulously good, centre of the footballing world, and they felt they should have won.
I know you're getting a great reaction to the book as well, Aidan. What do you want readers to get from your book, The Nearly Men?
That's a great question. I think an appreciation that football isn't solely about the winner. I think people can get blinded and say, well, this team is a failure and that team's a failure. Just show me how many trophies you've won. Well, you didn't win. You can't be any good. Mm. And that, especially in international football, where the opportunities are so few and, as you said, are restricted to so few nations, really.
Yes.
That can't be the right measure. There's other things to measure. And I think that's what I'm trying to get over, is that, okay, you might not win the trophy for whatever reason, but you've left something behind that, maybe it's, to some it's not quite as worthwhile, to others maybe it's more worthwhile. And that's what I'm trying to argue, that in some cases, what they've left behind in terms of the joy or the beauty or the artistry or the revolutionary style or the advancement or the impact on a nation or any of these things, what they've left behind in those regards is in many ways more important than victory would have been, or at least is just as worthy and worth remembering and celebrating. So it's to, I guess, to kind of, I'm a football romantic, a hopeless football romantic, if that's not coming across loud and clear. But that's the kind of view, is to make it, it's just to show and to celebrate the fact that it isn't solely about winning. There's a lot more that is left behind that's a huge positive, even in the teams that fall short and sometimes painfully so.
Yeah. And even some of the greatest players in the world never got to play in the World Cup finals. George Best being a point in case, you know, with Northern Ireland, obviously.
Well, exactly. I mean, a lot of it is down to luck of where you're from and what generation you're in. You know, Ireland, Northern Ireland in that case, very, very unlikely to ever be in a position to push to win a World Cup. And that is the reality for most countries, let's be honest, for most countries. And so the celebration, the joy has to be taken other ways. Now, in some cases, it's the joy of being at a tournament. I think obviously both islands have done that very, very well. For others, it's progressing to a quarterfinal or a semifinal, whatever the relevant bar is, if you like, of where success can be found or in what way success can be found. That should still be celebrated, because success, if it's only in trophies, well, you're only going to be happy if you're Italy or West Germany or Germany or Brazil or whoever, aren't you?
Yeah. And I just want to ask you, what do you think of the World Cup coming up? It's just around the corner. Obviously, it's a Winter World Cup, Qatar. What are your own feelings there? Are you looking forward to it?
I'm conflicted in a couple of ways. One, the whole moral argument of how it's come about. And all sorts of the issues about Qatar as a country and the whole corruption of the way it's been dealt with FIFA. However, you know, it's a World Cup, and I, if I'm being brutally honest, I'd be cutting my nose off to spite my face if I wasn't excited about it. I am, but it feels so weirdly different because it's in the winter. It's just not right as a football fan. It's not that it's winter, because other places it's been in winter. You know, South Africa, Argentina, they hosted Winter World Cups, but it was in the June-July time. That's an off-season, if you like, for world football, for most leagues, on the international calendar. That's where it's supposed to sit. That's where FIFA requested all bids would submitted were for hosting a June and July World Cup, not a Winter World Cup. That's what Qatar won it on. However they won it is a whole other matter. So to have it in winter and all the disruption it's caused, changes to the season, cramped schedules, the likelihood, and we're already seeing it already with players getting injured who are already being announced as going to miss the World Cup, it's going to make it slightly poorer for it. I think on one regard, I guess you could say, because it's not at the end of a long season, people may not be as tired. Perhaps, yes. But equally, I think everything's been sort of squashed together so much, especially with COVID beforehand, where schedules have been compressed to get all the games done. I think there'll be more injuries, more people missing out. I think also the fact that the big leagues, Premier League as well, finishes only a week before the World Cup. There's no preparation time. Mm. So I think we'll see a lot of teams not as good as they could have been. And I guess it's the attacking players probably what will suffer, because they'll focus on a bit of defensive organisation in many respects, I fear. So I think it won't be quite as good a spectacle as it could have been. And that's sad. In amongst a whole other host of reasons for it to be disappointing that it's Qatar and at this time. But at the end of the day, it's a World Cup, and I love the World Cup. Mm. And so I will be watching along and getting as excited as ever about each individual game and sort of living it, very much so.
Well, it's been great talking to you here on Premier League Live and Talk Sport. Aidan, good luck with the book. I'm almost finished it. I couldn't recommend it highly enough, and it'll be a great Christmas present, especially with the World Cup around the corner. Good timing in it as well, and it was great having you on. Before we leave it, final note, I suppose. Newcastle United doing all right, aren't they, Aidan?
A little bit better now. It feels weird. I can't cope with it. I'm not used to this. But yes, bizarrely, the best Premier League defensive record. That's just wrong. That's not what Newcastle United do.
Yeah.
But no, it's exciting times. And to have players of the quality of Bruno Guimarães, he's a whole level above the others that we've got. We've got some good players who Eddie Howe has clearly improved. You know, it isn't all with the money that's been spent. You know, sure, Guimarães, Trippier and various others have had a huge impact. I can't deny that. But equally, Eddie Howe has brought the best or the more out of the likes of Almiron, out of Joe Linton. A year ago, who'd have thought that? And that is astonishing that the team, in many cases, the same players who were doing so, so badly under Steve Bruce are now doing so well under Eddie Howe. And it's just galvanised the place. Coming back to how we began, Kevin Keegan in the 90s, the city felt different. It felt galvanised and energised and exciting. And there's an element of that again, because it's all-encompassing. You know, the city is the club, and the club is the city. And, you know, it's right there in the centre. And it does change the mood of the whole place. And that's wonderful to see.